have good trips back to where you are going to, both of you. Okay. Okay. So, Appeal 10-3330, Mikowski versus Smith Amundson, LLC. Good morning, Mr. DeGrand.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. We have raised issues in this case that can be grouped into three general categories. The admissions made by the Director of Human Resources for the defendant law firm. Number two, whether the evidence, whether the lower court erred in failing to consider any of the evidence in the record other than those admissions. And number three, whether the lower court properly analyzed the claim that the defendants unlawfully interfered with Ms. Mikowski's right to reinstatement under the Family Medical Leave Act.
I'd like to start you out with your first issue, because there certainly is evidence in this record that O'Gara carried out the executive committee's decision to eliminate her position after that decision had been made. But, of course, the critical inquiry in our case law is whether she was involved in it, whether O'Gara was involved in decision-making process affecting the employment action. And I guess what we need to hear is, what evidence do you have to show that O'Gara had anything to do with making or affecting the decision that eliminated Ms. Mikowski's position?
There are two emails in the record that surround the executive committee meeting or retreat that occurred in January of 2008. One at the beginning of that retreat from Mr. DeLarge to Ms. O'Gara, asking when Mikowski began her FMLA leave, and the second one at the conclusion of that retreat, in which Mr. DeLarge comments to O'Gara that Mikowski doesn't fit within the law firm culture. Other than that, I cannot point you to any evidence that O'Gara was consulted prior to the executive committee retreat. However, I don't believe that the decision-making process ended when Mr. Amundson decided to fire Mikowski. In fact, the decision-making process went forward with the determination, which was Ms. O'Gara's responsibility, regarding whether this, you know, the why of this decision. Why are we firing Mikowski? It's clearly not performance-based. How are we implementing this decision? What is the rationale for the decision? Does the decision violate federal law? Because, after all, Mikowski was in the protected category both because of her gender and her pregnancy. And those issues, especially the question of whether whether the law firm was violating federal law, was exactly O'Gara's job. O'Gara consulted with outside counsel to determine how to go about firing Mikowski before Mikowski was fired. O'Gara actually fired Hong, who was the only other individual allegedly impacted by this so-called organizational restructuring, and she explained to Hong on February 4th, when Mikowski was also fired, that the reason he was being fired was because of this so-called organizational restructuring. She also signed his separation agreement on behalf of the law firm. If she can be involved in implementing that process, she ought to be in a position to make admissions on behalf of the law firm. And more importantly, when she observed to Mikowski that she, Mikowski, and others at the law firm had been discriminated against, she was not just acting within the scope of her job. That was her job. Her testimony was that as the highest-level human resources employee within the law firm, she was charged with the responsibility of determining whether law firm decisions violated federal law, complied with anti-discrimination statutes. That was her job. That is what they paid her to do. And so when she made those comments, they were well within the scope of her agency as defined by cases in this circuit, such as Stevens and Williams. I would also note that O'Gara's testimony as to the scope of her job was unchallenged and remains unchallenged by the defendants. She testified, for example, that she was consulted from time to time regarding decisions to terminate administrative staff, like Makowski, like Hong. That was her job. And I would also point out, Your Honor, that, and this is an important point for us, the evidence in the record corroborates O'Gara's statements independently. For example, she told Makowski that Hong was fired for performance reasons. Of course, Makowski wouldn't have any independent basis to know that. We only were able to confirm that below as discovery was closing, and it turns out that, in fact, what she said was true. Hong was fired because he had performance problems. There was no job elimination. There was no organizational restructuring. In addition, she told Makowski, O'Gara told Makowski that there had been no organizational restructuring. That is something that had been invented by outside counsel for the firm. All of the independent evidence indicates that that, too, was true. So this is not a situation where a plaintiff is offering unsupported and uncorroborated admissions by someone employed by the defendant. And as I indicated, Ms. O'Gara did in fact participate in the decision-making process at issue here. In fact, below, before it became apparent that there would be testimony regarding these admissions, the defendants took the position that O'Gara was within the control group of the defendant law firm. We think the district court effectively reimposed the personal involvement requirement that has been rejected by this court in the Stevens and Williams decisions, and that was a mistake. But whether you view it as the scope of her agency or her actual involvement in the decision-making process at issue here, I think the conclusion has to be drawn that what she said could bind the firm, and her statements were admissible under Rule 801. And we also submit, as our second point, that the district court failed to consider other important evidence in the record. For example, 3 days after firing Makowski because her job was assertedly eliminated, the law firm began advertising for a business development and marketing manager. Makowski's job was director of marketing. We submit that the evidence shows that the business development and marketing manager position was just a euphemism for Makowski's job. And in fact, Sarah Goddard, the woman who actually replaced Makowski in May of 2008 and took the job of business development and marketing manager, testified that it's just a renaming of Makowski's job.
But how would that be inconsistent with the explanation that Smith Amundson has put forth that, forgive me, that the firm decided to eliminate one position in the marketing department and parcel out those responsibilities to the remaining employees? Because the bottom line here is that before February 2008, the marketing department had 3 full-time employees, and now it has only 2.
That is certainly true, and I would submit that's always true in a mini RIF. When one person is terminated and his or her duties are absorbed by others at the firm, you're always going to lose one person and one salary. But that does not mean that it is insulated from inquiry for discrimination. The question is, was the decision motivated by Makowski's pregnancy? And there's powerful evidence in the record that is what happened. What I believe happened, and what I believe the evidence shows happened, is that they did not replace Goddard, as they allege. They intended that Goddard would replace Makowski. When Goddard announced her resignation, they had to find someone else to replace Makowski. In addition, Hong was fired, as the record shows, for performance deficiencies. Including him in this organizational restructuring was just a fabrication. There was no job elimination. There was no organizational restructuring. The firm actually tried unwittingly to interview Makowski for her own job 2 months after they assertedly eliminated it. Internal law firm records show that the position of director of marketing was not, in fact, eliminated. For example, in May 2008, 3 months after they allegedly eliminated Makowski's position, Amundson recorded in his time entries that he had interviewed a candidate for the director of marketing position. And as we pointed out, the record also indicates that other employees have been discriminated against because of their pregnancies and leaves. These women have, despite dedication to the firm and its clients, been subjected to disparate treatment, withheld promotions, hostile work atmosphere, and comments such as, "There goes my part-time associate," and "Male associates are highly valued." And finally, the firm offered a series of shifting and inconsistent positions as to why they fired Makowski. They initially stated that the decision had nothing to do with Makowski's performance. They defended below by suggesting that she could not do the job as well as her replacement. They told Makowski that her job was eliminated, yet Amundson testified that she was replaced. He stated that the firm had decided, in his words, to invite another girl to the dance. The firm stated that as part of the restructuring, it had transitioned most of Makowski's job to Amundson. Amundson unequivocally denied that, and firm records indicate that the organizational restructuring consisted of exactly two people, Makowski and Hong, and below they tried improperly to expand that to include secretaries that were fired months later from the firm's St. Charles office, even as they had to acknowledge that there is not a single document in the record that supports that. Judge, we think it was improper for the court below to enter summary judgment against Makowski without considering any of this evidence. And finally, I just want to briefly note that we have raised the issue of the FMLA interference claim. I think the briefs are fine on that. I don't think I need anything in addition on that. And I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Ms. Naber, hello.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jennifer Naber. I represent Defendant Smith Amundson and the individual defendants Glenn Amundson and Michael DeLargy. This court properly entered summary judgment in favor of defendants in a case in which the plaintiff admitted that she never believed that she was discriminated against while she worked at the firm. She admitted that she never felt that she was treated differently during her entire pregnancy while she worked at the firm. She had no knowledge that anyone else was treated, or personal knowledge, anyone else was treated differently because they were pregnant or had taken FMLA leave while she worked at the firm. And just before she went on a maternity leave, she was in the process of nominating Smith Amundson for Crane's list of best places to work, and she believed it was a good place to work. With regard to
things change sometimes. O'Gara is responsible for managing Smith Amundson's compliance with the FMLA. She allegedly told Makowski that the firm discriminates against employees who take FMLA leave. Isn't that statement well within the scope of her employment?
Not in this particular case, Your Honor, because as the district court analyzed your opinions in Simple versus Walgreen and in Stevens versus Erickson, it's not simply what the person's job is, but it also involves whether, as you had noted, Judge Rovner, they were involved in the decision-making process affecting that particular employment action.
But if that statement is within the scope of her employment, doesn't that mean that it is a party opponent admission, as Mr. DeGrand says, admissible under Rule 801D2?
I don't believe so, because it's not only have to be whether it is in the scope of her employment in this particular case is debatable, because with regard to decisions that come out of the retreats that the executive committee has every year, the HR director is not involved in those decisions.
Well, let's assume that it is within her scope.
If it is within the scope, then the second prong needs to be met, that she was actually involved in the decision-making process. Not that she was involved in the decision itself or the employment action itself, but she was involved in the process. She was either consulted, had input, was the supervisor of Makowski, which none of those facts exist.
All the outside counsel before the plaintiff was told of her firing. If we look at all the inferences in the plaintiff's favor, why shouldn't we infer that that call to counsel was a necessary step or part of the decision-making process before the plaintiff would actually be fired?
Because each of the five members of the executive committee testified that they made the decision at the retreat. And, in fact, one of the attendees, Mr. DeLargy, although he's not a member of the executive committee, on his way back from that retreat, called Ms. O'Gara, told her the firm is implementing a restructuring. Two director positions are going to be eliminated. One is Ms. Makowski's position. The other one is going to be Mr. Hong's position, the director in information technology. Those decisions were made at the retreat. There is no contrary facts in the record to show otherwise.
But how could there be? What could Ms. Makowski possibly have come up with about a retreat at which she was not present. And when each of the individuals who is testifying has a very good reason to state what they stated.
Well, Ms. O'Gara, who wasn't part of the retreat, also testified that the decision was made. She didn't even know what the decision was until she got the call from Mr. DeLarghi. And also, she testified that until this litigation progressed, she wasn't even aware who made the recommendation to eliminate that position.
Now, of course, she also testified that she never said certain things that Ms. Makowski says she says. Why aren't those questions of fact for a jury?
In this case, the issue is taking Makowski's testimony as it is, whether it's admissible or not. And here, it's not admissible because it's hearsay and it doesn't meet the admission. So there is no question of fact.
Well, where's the hearsay when she says, she said?
Well, the hearsay is, we're assuming for purposes of the summary judgment, that the comment was made. Although Ms. O'Gara clearly and emphatically denies that that statement was made, for purposes of the motion for summary judgment, we have to assume that the statement was made, but our argument is it's not admissible because it's a hearsay statement and it didn't constitute an admission as the plaintiff's counsel has put forth.
I really don't understand. I'm going to make an admission myself. I've never understood hearsay. But but I really do not understand the hearsay component of that.
Well, the component,
well, you know, she's saying
it. The component is.
Have more experience.
Go ahead.
The issue is Makowski's testifying as to what O'Gara said, and assuming that O'Gara told her that, Makowski doesn't have the ability to testify as to what somebody else said for the truth of the matter asserted, which is what she's claiming that discrimination actually happened through. Allegedly through Agüero's words. So that's classic hearsay. The only reason it, as plaintiffs argue, wouldn't fall within hearsay is if it's an admission.
Right.
But we're saying that it's not an admission because O'Gara was never part of the decision-making process.
But isn't that a jury question? Yeah. It seems to me that this is clearly something that the jury should have decided here, whether this was made within the scope of her duties. And secondly, you're saying that she wasn't involved in the decision-making process. Why was she asked to make a phone call to outside counsel to run this by them to see if there was any concerns from outside counsel? If the decision had been made, there's no need for another phone call. Because no matter what they said, what outside counsel said, it wouldn't change their opinion or their decision, right?
Answering your questions in order, the
sure.
First one is actually this is an evidentiary issue, and we believe it's the district court's within his discretion of whether to grant allowing the hearsay in or not. So it wouldn't be an issue for the jury, but it's an issue for the court, and which we believe the district court properly ruled in this case. On the issue of contacting employment counsel after the decision was made, Ms. O'Gara clearly testified her role was merely to implement the documentation that had to go along with the termination, which was a severance agreement, and she just wanted to make sure the documentation was correct that she was going to be providing for them to implement the termination. And in fact, Ms. O'Gara was not even involved in the meeting with Ms. Makowski. That meeting was conducted by Mr. Omnison and Mr. DeLarghi.
But this reorganization and discussion about employee was not, my understanding of the record, was not even on the agenda of the retreat. And so this is just brought out of thin air. Or was it an add-on agenda item?
No, Your Honor. Actually, the whole purpose of the retreats, the five executive committee members meet annually basically to view the firm from top to bottom. They've done it since they started the firm for over 15 years. They make decisions on staffing, on compensation. The agenda pretty much stays the same for the categories of topics that they discuss. They do not put the detail in of what they're going to discuss because the agenda is created by clerical staff, it is seen by others in the firm, and they certainly do not want to put in that we're considering eliminating certain positions or reorganizing certain departments. And as Mr. Amundson testified, it's really putting aside those 3 days each year gives him the opportunity to sit down and look at everything. And he does that. They go to Florida, and he sits there and figures out what he's going to do. And, in fact, he testified, and he knew the marketing department could be reduced. He wasn't quite sure how he was going to effectuate the reduction. He was the liaison with the marketing department and knew it very well. In fact, you know, performed a lot of duties with the marketing department. And when he got down there, he realized it made the most logical sense to eliminate the $95,000 a year director of marketing position, given the fact that Ms. Makowski and Ms. Goddard testified that over the course of all of 2007, Ms. Makowski was transitioning her day-to-day marketing duties to Ms. Goddard because Ms. Makowski was planning on picking up larger development projects and a client survey project that were going forward, and it would go forward into 2008. Well, when Mr. Amundson got down to the retreat, he realized at this point they probably shouldn't be taking on these large marketing projects, and the client survey perhaps could be scaled back. And maybe the best way to approach this, since the marketing day-to-day tasks are already being performed by Ms. Goddard and Ms. Siegel, that...
But hadn't these big projects already been budgeted for?
No, sir. The client survey was going forward, but realizing after they even did the first client interview, it took up so much time of members of the executive committee and Ms. Makowski that they knew that they had to scale that project down because they weren't going to be able to invest the time and the money into the type of project that was going forward. And so by the time that Ms. Makowski went on maternity leave, basically the day-to-day operations of the marketing department were being operated through the lower two staff, Ms. Goddard and Ms. Siegel. And with regard to any of the other alleged allegations, they're even more tenuous, with Ms. Makowski testifying that Ms. O'Gara said others within the department or law firm were discriminated against. The only name mentioned was Carrie Von Hoff. And she was an attorney with the firm, which Ms. O'Gara would not have any HR function with, especially with regard to employment actions or any kind of adverse employment action.
In fact, Ms. Sort of getting into this area that Ms. Makowski hasn't provided enough information about the four employees who also claim to have been discriminated against for taking leave or becoming pregnant. And I was wondering how much information you think an employee needs to submit before her Me Too evidence is enough to stave off summary judgment. For example, did she need to conduct a mini trial to show that the two associates who were passed over for partner have viable discrimination claims against the firm?
Well, I think, first of all, for presenting Me Too evidence, the plaintiff needed to put that information in their additional set of facts under 56.1, which they did not do. A lot of the facts that they submitted to the district court and before this court were never included in their additional statement of facts. Even, you know, saying that, even looking at the facts, the plaintiff has to connect those facts to what has happened in this case. There's no connection between promotion to partnership decisions and a restructuring of administrative staff.
Well, unless the reasoning behind it all is precisely the same, allegedly here, difficult pregnancies or pregnancies.
But none of that information was presented below. In fact, for the most part, the two attorneys that they focus on left voluntarily. The one had two children while she was employed at the firm, and both of them testified or wouldn't testify that they believe that they had been discriminated against while they worked at the firm. The other two individuals that they named, they presented no testimony on those individuals or from those individuals, and I believe the evidence that they did present is hearsay through an EEOC charge and some emails that were presented. With regard to the ultimate decision of the district court, basically what Judge Dara found was that the plaintiff did not show that the defendant's reasons for implementing the restructuring were false reasons and that discrimination was the true reason. The plaintiff, Makowski, had the burden to show pretext and provide significantly probative, admissible evidence to show that the reason was false. although Ms. Makowski's attorney can speculate what he thought would happen and that O'Gara looked into the whys of why what happened, none of that is in the record, and there's no evidence that Ms. O'Gara investigated anything or looked into the whys of what happened. And in fact, to the contrary, Ms. O'Gara said she never inquired as to the decision. She was told of the decision, told to simply put paperwork together, and the restructuring had occurred with not only the director of marketing position being eliminated, but also the director of information technology. The other decisions that were made at the executive committee meeting in January was this restructuring in the St. Charles office, in which the male managing partner of that office was moved to the Chicago office. A female attorney who was already at that office was made the managing partner. They needed to reduce the administrative staff at that office, but wanted that female managing partner to get a sense of what information and how much clerical staff she needed before they told us she had to make that decision. Those decisions occurred later in May when the two female employees were terminated, but all of that was part of the decisions that came out in January 2008, and Makowski has not presented any evidence to the contrary. With regard to the pretext issue, as I said, that's what the court ultimately looked at, although Makowski claims that the district court did not review any of the other evidence. What the district court actually found was that other than the O'Gara statement, which the court found was hearsay, none of the other evidence presented connected Makowski's action to any discriminatory motive. And so we ask for this court to affirm the district court's summary judgment.
The judge states that in one sentence. And you're indicating that that one sentence indicates that he's looked at all of this and considered it all, and nothing arises to challenge the pretext.
And in looking at the evidence that the district court looked at, none of it does rise to the issue of, to the level of challenging what happened. None of it was connected to what happened with the restructuring that occurred or the decisions that were made at the January 2008 retreat. That's how the evidence played out. Although they submit this other information, there was no attempt to connect either decision makers or the employment decisions, anything to what happened with Ms. Makowski in this case. If you have no further questions.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Neighbor. Okay, Mr. DeGrand has how many minutes left?
4 minutes
left.
Thank you, Your Honor. The first thing I want to point out is with respect to the allegation that this organizational restructuring included employees at the St. Charles office. That is nothing short of an expansion, of an attempt to expand and change the game after the fight had been joined. If you look at the record, and this is at R166-2, and it's Exhibit 22 of the Amundson deposition, he sent an email on February 4th, 2008, in a very detailed explanation of the organizational restructuring that was being implemented. There were two positions impacted, and only two. There is not a single document in the record that indicate. And in fact, Mr. Amundson testified in his deposition that he didn't know when the decision had been made to fire these other women from the St. Charles office. It's just testament to the fact that the entire organizational restructuring is a make-it-up-as-you-go story by the defendants, and it's absolute pretext. We think it was a mistake for the lower court not to address those aspects of our case. I would also point out that O'Gara told Makowski on the day that she was fired that other employees had been terminated because of their pregnancies and leaves, and she mentioned one by name, Carrie Von Hoff. Again, Makowski would have no way of knowing that Carrie Von Hoff had complained about being treated differently because of her pregnancy, but it turns out that in her testimony, Ms. Von Hoff did testify to dramatically different treatment that she received in the immediate aftermath of having announced her first pregnancy. The defense counsel notes that she and Ms. Langevitz did not say what was in the mind of the decision makers here, as of course they cannot, but they certainly testified to the disparate treatment that they received after having announced their pregnancies. And finally, I would note that Rule 801 D2D speaks in terms of job duties, and that's what the court has held in Stevens and Williams. You look not at involvement in the decision, you look at the job responsibilities and whether the employees alleged admission matches their job responsibilities or their job description. Here, that is clearly met. O'Gara was the person charged by the firm to determine whether the law firm's decisions complied with federal law. She observed to Mikowski that the firm's decision did not comply with federal law. That was right in her wheelhouse. That was her job. So for those reasons and the other reasons we've set forth as well in our briefs, we would ask that the lower court's opinion and judgment be reversed.
Thank you, Mr. DeGran.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. Nicely done.